Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Your brain is going to change to reflect whatever it is you're doing. So choose your behaviors carefully.
So how do we learn? And why do some of us learn things more easily than others?
You have to be kidding, right? I said, what have you been doing?
Dr. Lara Boyd.
Dr. Lara Boyd.
Canada's research chair in neurobiology and learning.
Really, really interested in how the brain changes when we learn.
Everything you do, everything you encounter is changing your brain.
And so the reason why that's important information is because we only have one brain. You can shape it however way you choose to.
Go out and build the brain you want.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, really good, thank you. Thank you so much for your time. I've been looking forward to this one for quite a while. I know we've been like back and forth in respect to calendars, but we're here now, so all is good.
Yeah.
So before we dive into it, let's start with a bit of a background into who you are, what you do, and why.
Sure. So my name is Lara Boyd. I am a professor and a Distinguished University Scholar at the University of British Columbia. So that's the formal stuff. Probably the more interesting stuff is I have a background in sports and actually also as a physiotherapist, and put those things together and sought out advanced training in neuroscience because I'm just really, really interested in how the brain changes when we learn and when we learn new movements, learn new facts, and also as we learn throughout the lifespan.
Yeah, definitely. So let's start with that journey. What got you into neurobiology and what drove a focus towards neuroplasticity and human physiology?
Yeah, I had my first degree is actually as a clinical physical therapist, physio, and I was working trying to help patients who'd had stroke, and I was really, really frustrated. So I just felt like I was being asked to help repair something and I didn't know how it worked. So I always say it's like, imagine being a car mechanic and having no idea how your car engine works, like no clue whatsoever. That's kind of how I felt as a physio trying to help someone with damage in their brain from a stroke. So I decided the only way I could actually do this kind of work was to go back and try to understand how does the brain work. And I at some level got just really lucky because about the time I was having this kind of existential crisis in my mid-20s, we started seeing some of the very first evidence of widespread, you know, brain-centered neuroplastic change. There was a time, probably before 1995, where we actually didn't think the brain could change. So in my early career, when I was a master's student, for example, in my clinical career, we were taught the brain didn't change probably after about puberty. So we had this whole scale kind of massive upheaval. And out of that came the field of neuroscience. So neuroscience actually wasn't even a degree you could get until, you know, the late 90s into the 2000s. And so it's somewhat like I got just lucky because I kind of hit it at the right time. That was about the time I was starting into my advanced training, into my doctoral degree. So it was a really exciting time to be a student because things were changing just incredibly fast, just new knowledge, just day after day after day, week after week. And some of that came from the advent of technologies that let us now look in the brain. So MRI, for example, we didn't really have these, you know, brain MRIs or MRIs that were focused on, you know, research until the 2000s. They started to emerge and now they're kind of everywhere. We do them all the time. That was a real game changer in letting us look in, see what's happening. And then that's just kind of expanded from there. We now have tools where we can not only look in the brain and watch it, but, you know, I use brain stimulators in my research and I can alter and interact with the brain in real time as it's changing. So it's just been a really, really exciting few decades as neuroscience has become a field.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's also intriguing that some of these misconceptions have now been debunked, which is encouraging. But I guess there's still a broader question in respect to how do we actually learn? And I guess also why do some people find it easier to learn rather than others?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I know the answer to the second question. That's something I'm acutely interested in. So why are people, some people really good at learning languages and other people aren't, is an example that I often use. But how we learn, you know, and basically we now understand that every time we learn a new fact, a new skill, a new movement, we change our brain. And so our brain's kind of constantly changing. It doesn't stop changing at the end of childhood. It's basically changing probably from conception until death. And maybe if we had better tools, we'd realize it was changing after death. I really don't know. I've become really reluctant to say anything is definite anymore because I feel the more we learn, the more I realize I was wrong before. And I feel like I just have to go back and apologize to all those people I told the wrong information to. So as of today, we know that our brain is always changing throughout life. And that's learning. So our brain can also change when we forget things, when we unlearn them, and with disease and pathology as well. So basically the brain is just changing constantly, and it can change for better or for worse, depending on what's happening.
Also about the changes, we mentioned the ability that we can consistently learn, and you can pick up things like guitar into your really elder ages, and you can learn those kind of new motor skills as well. But back to the misconceptions, really, before we kind of move on to the ability to learn, like what, from your research, what other misconceptions about neuroplasticity have you helped to clarify and I guess also like overturn?
Yeah. So I think the big one, there used to be this real idea that older individuals don't learn and or people have less capacity for change in the brain or even recovery after the brain's damaged as we get into older age. And we now know that that's not true at all. I used to hear neurologists say things like, oh, well, that patient who's had a stroke, they're over 65, so they're not going to recover. Well, that's completely untrue. We now know there's kind of no real age limit. The brain ages, and that does kind of change how much and how fast plasticity happens, but we're so individual, it doesn't seem to be uniquely tied to our chronological age. So we have 80-year-olds we're studying in my lab, and their brains look like they're 50. And we have 50-year-olds who, unfortunately, their brains look like they're 80, right? It doesn't really map onto how many years. So that's one big one. I think the other one is just what's changing in the brain and the time scale of those change. So we used to really think that when the brain changes, most of the change happened on the outside layers of the brain. It's called the cortex. This is where our brain's really connecting neurons together. And that is true. Those areas change really well and really fast. But we now know that the other kind of connecting tracts of the brain, we call it white matter, that those tracts of the brain are also highly neuroplastic as well. They change with different stimuli, they change at a different time scale. But this is also a really important part of brain change associated with learning. So those are some of the two kind of more exciting things that help us design new learning interventions or design new therapies, because you kind of know the scale of what can change and then when it can change. Why some people are better than others though, this is a tricky question, and I would love to start to be able to unpack that. We are massively unique from person to person. Some of us are really good at learning movements and sport and music and those kinds of things we can really accomplish. Other people are really good at numbers, some people at letters, some people at languages. So we do have these unique abilities, whether they're innate or they're just things we've really trained carefully over time, that part I'm not clear about.
You touched upon something interesting. I've not heard the topic before, but white matter. Can you like what's the details behind that?
Yeah, so I have to kind of back up a little bit and give a quick seminar in human cortical physiology and anatomy. So if you think about the cells in our brain, the major cell is called a neuron. It's just your major brain cell, and it has different parts to it. So think of it looking like a tall tree. So you have kind of a body to it. So that might be like your root system, if you will. It's called a cell bottom or a cell body or a soma, excuse me. And coming off that cell body are these little kind of fine projections. They look like branches in a tree. They're called dendrites. And so those branches are how one cell, one neuron communicates with the neuron next to it. So they communicate by not actually touching one another. They come very close, these kind of projections come very close. And they then send little chemical packets. It's called neurotransmitters. This little chemical transmission of signals from kind of dendrite through to another dendrite. So that's how those cells are talking. So when you do an image of the brain, that part of the brain, those cell bodies and those dendrites connecting with other cell bodies, they look gray on an MRI. So that's where we get this idea of gray matter. And this is, we know that these dendrites can rapidly reorganize. You can add connections, detract connections, you can increase and decrease the amount of chemical really fairly rapidly. And so we've known that this was a major system of change in the brain for many years. Once that neuron is activated, once it gets an impulse to kind of do something, it will often, it needs to then send that impulse far to another area of the brain, to another, connect to another part and activate that other neuron pool. And so this would be like the trunk of the tree, right? This long connection. And so those long connections are actually wrapped in fat and it looks white. And so we call that white matter. So actually, you know, I always remind people like fat is not bad. Actually, we use it as insulation on our neurons, just the same way as you have insulations on the wires going to your microphone, right? If you didn't, that signal decays and you lose it over distance. The brain's no different. And so we know that these long connections to different brain regions are very vulnerable to damage. They're not as able to change as the gray matter parts are, as the cell body parts are. And we always thought, for many years, we thought they never changed, that they were very static. You think about them like the roads around your house. They just don't change. Turns out that's not true at all, that this fat that's insulating the kind of line, if you will, the cells that create that insulation, that they are rapidly and in real time changing to change the speed of the transmission of that information. So they can become thicker, which makes the information transmit faster, or they can become thinner, which slows it down. So you almost think about them as like modulating the speed of information as it travels across the brain, because what you want to do is you want to get the right information to the right place, but you also have to get it there at the right time. So we want cells to get their signals together at the same time. So if information is coming from one part of the brain and another part of the brain, you want it to arrive coincidentally. So if you take it to like a real world kind of example, let's say that I'm driving my car down the street and a ball rolls in front of my car. Maybe there's a small child or a dog chasing that ball, right? So I've got to take in a lot of information. Basically, what I want to stop my car as fast as possible, right? So I don't drive over anybody or anything. So I'm taking that visual information. I've got to get it to my motor areas of the brain. We've got to get it to the frontal cortex, make a decision, and then send an output to my foot to step on the brake really fast. So you need all of that to be transmitted really quickly. But in the decision part of the brain, you need to get all that information there at the right time. So ball in the road, really need to stop, send signal out. That has to arrive coincidentally. And that's what this insulation is doing, is it's modulating the speed of that information flow. It does it really rapidly. And when it's damaged, you have a big problem. So this insulation is called myelin, and it's the structure that's actually affected by multiple sclerosis. So multiple sclerosis is a disease where your myelin gets attacked by your immune system. And you have very severe deficits in whatever part of the brain that attack is happening in. And so that's how we know it's a very critical structure. But now what's exciting is to know that it can change both for learning, and then also perhaps we can change it to help people with multiple sclerosis get better, is the kind of, if you keep through on that through line. So that's what I mean by white matter.
From an MS perspective, how far away do you think that potential for healing may be?
Well, you know, there are drugs right now that are designed to be remyelinating drugs that try to go and promote the health of the myelin. The real focus in MS has been on trying to push down that immune response that's attacking the myelin. It's kind of part one. And then part two is help the myelin get better. So I think there's a lot of optimism around treatment. In MS, there's also a lot of optimism around prevention. We now think that maybe one of the sources that sets off MS is a virus, the Epstein-Barr virus, which if you could maybe design a vaccine, for example, is the thinking, to prevent people from getting Epstein-Barr, you could perhaps eliminate the disease multiple sclerosis. That would be a pretty exciting day for neuroscience, clinical neuroscientists, right? So that's where a lot of the focus of the field is. But just even understanding these mechanisms and how the myelin can change and, you know, be affected and then recover, gives a lot of hope for the patients and families who have that disease that they're working against.
Yeah, definitely. As a family, we've been touched by it as well. So it's not the nicest of things, but these challenges in respect to the wider opportunities that are there in society and there in advancements, it's encouraging to hear. So looking at challenges as a whole, I'm intrigued as to the insights in respect to learning and memory, especially in the context of education, aging, and the classic dilemma, short and long-term memory loss.
Yeah. So long-term memory loss is the really hard one, right? That we really struggle with. So we really don't have a lot of good therapies for dementia. And it's not for lack of trying. People have just struggled mightily against Alzheimer's pathology and dementia-related diseases. One thing we have learned in the dementia field that's been really helpful is that there's a lot of different reasons for dementia. So one of the most common ones is actually having a lot of little strokes. So that's called vascular cognitive impairment. So you have many strokes and their accumulation can lead to a dementia. And so the reason why that's important information is because those little strokes are not easy to prevent, but there are things we can do. We can modify our lifestyle. We can prevent having more of them happen once we realize that they're taking place in people's brains. And so that's been really important. In terms of reversing Alzheimer's type dementia, that's a different kind. That's where we see, for whatever reason, the neurons of the brain lose their organization, they become tangled, and we start to build up some kind of byproducts of that we also see when brains are damaged, something called beta amyloid that will start to build up in the brain, and that causes almost like these plaques, these areas of like sticky, non-functional brain. Those together accumulate to cause the Alzheimer's pathology. We don't really have a good treatment there for those types of disorders. And I think that that's a real struggle. And so what happens then is the brain is kind of reorganizing around, trying to accommodate for that damage, trying to make up for it as best as it can through different principles of neuroplasticity until you kind of just run out and then you start to see really big clinical declines. And so that's a huge problem that the field is really grappling with. I think the field of Alzheimer's research is really struggling to come up with new ideas and new theories of what is the real source cause of the pathology so that they can design new treatments. And unfortunately, we haven't made as much progress as we'd like.
It's intriguing how everything's evolving because there's so many opportunities, you know, we'll touch upon it later, but how you're utilizing robotics in your work as well. I picked up on that. That was quite keen to explore, but like there's also that dilemma that a lot of people look at. So when you imagine people at school, some people flow through schools really easily and some people struggle. And then you go to the next stage of like learning. Some people struggle with passing their driving test, for example, other people don't. And why can't we learn anything that we choose to with ease? And why do some people struggle?
Why do people struggle so much? So everyone learns. I mean, everyone's brain changes. That's kind of the first thing to start with. And I think especially when we think about kids in school, schools are designed kind of as a one size fits all, right? And it's great if you fit that size. Like this is the age where we learn maths, and this is the age where we introduce a second language, et cetera. And it works for the majority of kids. But I think that there are subsets of kids on either end of that distribution who the school just is either too slow because they're really good at something in particular, or it's just really hard and it's not designed for them at that particular time. And part of what's happening in the field of educational neuroscience right now is trying to start to understand at what age are certain capacities developed so that, and you can kind of time when are you learning, you know, multiplication, for example, when is the brain ready for that information? Our educational system has been designed just on intuition, like it in terms of neuroscience, in terms of actual understanding how brain changes when. And so that people are starting now to back into that and try to understand, you know, how does the brain, like when we learn to read, what happens in the brain? What is changing that all of a sudden all of these squiggly letters on our screen just make effortless sense, right? I just look at it and I know what it means. I'm not even, it takes no effort whatsoever once you become really good at it. So that's a really exciting field. So why do some kids struggle though? I mean, I think that is an outstanding question. We don't really know. Is it because there's something different about their brain, different about how they're processing and perceiving the world and information in it. Probably both of those things are true. But I want to be really clear that those kids are still learning. They're just learning very differently, either different information or at a different rate. And so we can design educational systems for them. They just are going to have to be much more individualized. And just in general, I think we would do better if we could individualize education for everyone, right? That we all are better at some things than others. And that is just a reflection of our unique brain. A little bit what we've genetically come with, a little bit because of what we like and what we practice more and we engage in more. That also will shape the brain, you know, throughout life. And a little bit just because of our environment. We know there's a very strong relationship between being a good reader and having been read to from a tiny infant. Like, people read to their babies in utero and immediately when the child is born and then throughout. So the amount of what's called print in a household is very directly related to the reading capabilities of children who grow up in that house. So it also is telling you that from the start, these kind of environmental influences are shaping the brain and then the learning capacity of that child later on.
Yeah, there's a stat, and I'm not sure if it's right or wrong. Correct me if I'm wrong about it. A lot of people are telling me at the moment in respect to children, there's an evolution stage up until the age of seven where they're at that kind of real sponge moment where they're taking everything in. But then after that, the ability to learn and develop isn't as easy. Is that true or false? The reason I ask that question is because obviously we have three children under the age of three. So I'm very conscious as a parent. Is this the case?
Yeah. I don't know if up to seven is like the right number. Like, I'm really hesitant, right? I told you before, I'm going to be wrong, right? I'm sure that just an apologies to everyone in advance. Something I tell you today will be wrong in 2 years because we'll have learned something new. That's kind of exciting, really. But we do know there's something special about that young child that makes them particularly capable the younger they are to take in new information. It doesn't necessarily mean that you lose capacity as you get older. You might just be changing the brain in different ways, right? So those young experiences, even though like very, you know, little, your kids all under three, they may not look like they're learning anything, but they're learning an awful lot right now. And that may relate differently to different skills as well. So there's something really special about kids who grow up hearing two languages, right, from birth on. Those kids are typically talk a little bit later than kids who are monolingual, but they develop their language centers in a way that's really unique, such that they're almost always fluently bilingual for the rest of their lives. And they often wind up being multilingual, right? They have the two languages and they add a third or fourth. And these are these people who can speak five languages and they can kind of flip back and forth. There's something different about how their brain has been shaped to acquire a language. And there's something really special about starting that very young, very early. Doesn't mean you can't learn it later, but especially with language is one of these examples where the older we get, just the harder it is. So here in Canada, a lot of our kids, because we have two official languages, English and French, a lot of our kids will start and go into French immersion, but they kind of have two time points they can go in. They can go in kindergarten and do all their education in French, or they can go in the sixth grade, and they start in grade year six, and they go 6 to 12 in French. In 12th grade, no matter if you started in kindergarten or in year six, by year 12, both of those groups of kids are fluent in French. They speak, they read, and they can converse easily in French. However, the kids who are started younger, they have the perfect accent. There's something about their ear that's different. So they sound better. So they have the perfect accent. Whereas the kids who start a little bit later, they tend to have better grammar in the second language. So they're better at learning kind of the language rules, the conjugations, the feminine, masculine pronouns, all of that stuff. So there's these differences, and it shows you just learning something at a different time in your development leads to different outcomes. So it's an interesting kind of experiment the country of Canada has embarked upon.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things I wanted to talk about as well was obviously trauma. I look at the work that you've done and the research that you've done. It's something I really want to dig into. But before we kind of delve into the elements of trauma, you talked about brain stimulation earlier and also exercise. And we touched briefly about the topic of robotics. But in your research, like, you talk about priming the brain. So can you elaborate upon those particular stimulations, exercise, robotics, and how you go about priming the brain to drive neuroplastic change?
Right. So this is something we've been really interested in doing in my lab. So can we speed up learning? Could you learn something faster? In part, we come to that work because after someone damages their brain, let's say you have a stroke or a traumatic brain injury, most of our societies, we have a relatively limited time where we have the opportunity to do rehabilitation. It's limited both by our brain being particularly capable of recovery for a short time after the injury. We seem to be extra neuroplastic. Yeah. And also it's limited just by financial constraints. Like, we only pay for so much therapy, right? And it tends to be the first maybe 1 to 3 months after the injury. And so the idea here is, can you speed it up? Could you get more out of that 3 months of rehab? So starting in some literature that where we're using brain stimulation, we know that we can apply stimulation into the brain and we can make the cortex more excitable. And we use a tool called transcranial magnetic stimulation, and we can drive repetitive pulses of this electromagnetic stimulation into the top layers of the brain. And if we give enough of them at the right frequency, we can see an after effect where we get the brain more excitable. It stays excitable for a period of time. And my group and others have done experiments where if you get the brain more excitable and it's in that after period where it's still up, if you practice something there in that time frame, you see more learning than if you don't stimulate. So it kind of led to this realization that we can pre-amplify the brain. We can like turn it up and then practice something and learn more. So the question then became, do we always have to stimulate the brain? Or are there other things we could do? So if I stimulate the brain, the thing is with my stimulators, I can only stimulate one area. Well, what if I want the whole brain to be more excitable? So we started looking around at different therapies, and one that does this really well is exercise. So it turns out that doing a short bout of very intense exercise totally excites the whole brain. And so this is another way that you can prime or prepare the brain to learn. So we've done lots and lots of experiments where people do a bout of high intensity exercise. It's 9 minutes of really hard cycling. And then we pair that with trying to practice to learn something new. And we see elevated amounts of learning across time. So we've done something similar with robotics. And this would be with people who have stroke or have an arm that doesn't work very well. And so also, again, can you use that robot to assist the movements, to make the movements in a different way? It also amplifies brain excitability and it reinforces that practice so that you speed up recovery or you speed up learning depending on kind of what the goal is.
That's amazing.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. So talking about like the ability to gauge some lessons, I guess, from the studies that you've done to the brain of post-stroke, how do these findings, I guess, extend to other areas of neuroscience and also wider society and learning?
Yeah. So I think they kind of, they show us a couple things. They show that even a damaged brain can learn. Like you can have big damage in your brain and you can show learning and change. You see that the brain doesn't lose that capacity. And because we're studying people with stroke, they're older, they have less of their health concerns. So we still see these very kind of sick brains, lots of things going on in them, still keeping that capacity. The exercise work is really exciting because that's something that's quite easily applied to daily life. We can all go out right now and do some intervals, either on a bicycle or running, and we can see these changes in the ability of our brain to then take in new information. And you could think about using this even going back to the, when we were talking about kids, maybe kids who are having trouble learning, maybe you could try to amplify the impact of a school session by having them do exercise immediately before it and then engaging in some classroom material. That's an experiment I've always wanted to do and I haven't. But circling back to just the exercise stuff, the other thing to be mindful of in that is that we know that exercise has this very big effect on different systems in the brain too. So the one that it really affects the largest effect is on learning something cognitive. So like preparing for an exam, so facts, learning things like that are really amplified. So it also amplifies our ability to learn new movements. And then we have a new set of data actually showing that the other piece that it really helps is modifying movements when you have to put a rule on top of them, which is most of our movements. We're making a movement in some kind of purpose, goal-driven, maybe outside modified way. You have to reach a certain way in order into your mailbox to, you know, get it out. Or when you're driving, there's lots of rules you're having to apply to your movements, right? You're taking in information, just stop when you need to stop and go when it's your turn to go, things like that. So it seems like exercise is really, really important for these kind of really high level types of events and decision makings.
And yeah, I guess like from the stroke perspective and I guess like post-trauma, what have been some of the standout findings that you've come across during your work?
Yeah. So the big focus of the stroke work now in my group is trying to understand that the variability we see from person to person. So we talk about stroke as if it's a single condition. People had a stroke. But it turns out your stroke can happen in any place in the brain. And depending on where it happens, you look very different. And then even within similar strokes, people tend to recover very, very differently afterwards. And that's been a real source of frustration and difficulty because it's very difficult to predict how well is someone going to recover, when, how long will it take, and kind of what's the best therapy for that patient. So trying to really personalize those decisions, I think, is a really important piece so we can optimize the outcome. So we've been studying what are called biomarkers. So a biomarker is something we can measure that will help us understand the answers to those questions. Will they recover, when, and what's the best therapy? Kind of allowing us to then subgroup people and give them the correct therapy at the right time. And so a lot of our work has been focused on studying people with very severe strokes. So big stroke with very seemingly poor opportunity for recovery. Because we know that a lot of the people that have these very large strokes, they look very, very disabled immediately after stroke. They often aren't even offered rehabilitation because the stroke is so severe. And yet they do retain a good deal of capacity for recovery. So it's an important decision point of, this is a patient who just needs more time before they go to rehab. Is it someone who needs a specialized therapy? And that's going to be what really kickstarts their brain. Or are they someone who maybe we're not going to see a great deal of recovery and we need to teach them to compensate, to do things in a new way from how they did them before, because those old abilities aren't going to come back. So we do a lot of brain imaging with those people and have been able to kind of outline what we think in the brain is a compensatory pathway that people use to get a lot of recovery after they have a lot of damage in their brain. And it's helping us hopefully get those people into therapy at the right time so that they can kind of optimize that and hopefully get back to some approximation of their daily life.
Yeah, that's amazing. So what specific examples have you seen from biomarkers and also individual variability? That whole personalized element in recovery as well is quite intriguing.
Yeah, I think it's really important. So we have, I can think of examples of cases. One comes really to mind of an individual, a man who had actually two very big strokes, extremely disabled, lost his language ability, was more or less confined to a wheelchair. And he just honestly, of sheer force of will, started engaging in a very intense exercise activity, just forced himself. And it was really remarkable. So for his brain, he was able to, using this exercise kind of to leverage neuroplasticity, to start to make, you know, some recovery. He was able then to kind of get out of his wheelchair, started to do some walking. And this is over the course of about 2 years. And we kept encouraging him. We started doing more walking. And about 2 years on, a person walked into my research lab. I didn't recognize him, and says, "Hi, Dr. Boyd." And I was like, "No, you have to be kidding, right?" I said, "What have you been doing? Like, you're walking, you're talking, like, what on earth?" And he said he continued to exercise. He ran out of all his therapeutic options, so he hired a personal trainer, and he'd been in one of the big buildings downtown, and every day he did all the stairs to the top and back down again, like 20 some odd stairs, which I'm not recommending, because falling down a huge bunch of, I was terrified as a former physical therapist. I was a little horrified that this was his exercise, because it seemed so unsafe. But he had done this now for many days in a row, and both his walking, he got strong, his cardiovascular fitness improved. All, you know, exercise promotes blood flow to the brain, it enhances neuroplasticity, it changes excitability. And with that and a lot of intense practice, his language function also recovered. And he was 1,000,000% different. It was a shockingly exciting difference. It took a long time. It took a lot of effort. But for his unique brain and the lesions in his brain, this was kind of the road to a really amazing recovery for him. And I hope he's kept it up. I haven't seen him now for a little bit. But he really stands out as someone who did something very unique and personal to his situation and was able and to see a lot of recovery.
Did you ever get the opportunity to do the contrast between his brain at the time of trauma to his brain post?
I didn't, and I would absolutely love to. Unfortunately, I saw him right before we shut down for the pandemic, right? So I didn't get the chance to get him back. And I really hope he's still doing, the good news is I haven't seen him again, which means he's probably doing well. He hasn't come back through the hospital system or into my lab for anything. So I assume that's really good news. So he is one kind of remarkable example, but there are others, and not everyone has such an extreme amount of recovery, but some people do really well with exercise. We've had other people really benefit from the brain stimulation. Other people just need a lot of practice, just getting people up and just practice of whatever it is they want to do. Is it walking? Is it carrying their grandchild, swinging their golf club, whatever that thing is, they may just need to, you know, really focus upon it. And then that trickles back. And so it just kind of depends on where you want to go.
We've talked about things like MS and dementia. We've talked about stroke. But bearing in mind, like, modern society's issues in respect to epidemics of isolation, loneliness, etc., mental health, what have you had an opportunity to delve into the whole epidemic of mental health, and be it things like stress, anxiety, burnout, and what have you witnessed from those particular findings and elements of research?
Yeah, so we've done a little bit of this work in my lab. We have some studies planned on burnout in particular, but I could just be able to start by speaking to kind of the epidemic of mental health. And it's scary, actually, I think, to look around me, and especially in youth and adolescence. A lot of that, it comes from isolation. We know that social interaction is really healthy for the brain. It's one of the things, you know, there are these groups of individuals, a few pockets around the world where people live to be over 100 years of age on average. Blue zones, right?
Blue zones.
And so, and so when you look at those, what's different about those things? One of the big things that falls out is that people have rich social interactions, right? Yeah. Rich social networks. And so that is really seems to be being lost either through, I mean, this is wonderful, this kind of technology. We can talk and late at night there and afternoon here, and we're worlds apart. On the other hand, if it's the only, you know, it's the only way we interact with someone today, that's maybe not so healthy. So we know that changes the excitability of the brain. And then, of course, the whole epidemic, I think it's an epidemic of people just being mean. I don't even know how else to label it. It's really out on the brain, right? It's not good to always, you know, be able to be torn into by anyone and just the discourse. But we do know that there are some good therapies for clinical depression. One of them actually is brain stimulation. I'm not an expert in this field. I have colleagues who are. But we know that brain stimulation has a very positive effect on severe depression and is now a clinical treatment in the United States and Canada. I don't know about Europe, whether or not it's approved there, but it is approved here as one of the treatments. But the other thing that can really counteract stress, and with depression comes a lot of stress, again, I sound like a broken record, it's actually exercise. So when we're stressed, we release the hormone cortisol. And then when the cortisol is high, because we're continually stressed and it stays high, it has a whole bunch of really negative effects. And one of them is to decrease neuroplasticity. It decreases capacity for plastic change in the brain. So it makes it harder to learn. And we all know that feeling, right? If you're like so stressed, you can't even think, you can't learn, you're kind of just flooded. And so that's high cortisol. And when cortisol is really high, it pushes down some of what we call growth factors in the brain. Where I was talking about early in our conversation about having our dendrites and they reorganize to accommodate learning. And so in order to do that, we have these other chemicals in the brain called growth factors that get expressed. And they allow these dendrites to be more easily able to change. When cortisol is high, those growth factors are low. They compete for a spot to attach in the brain. And so that prevents learning. And so you're stressed and you're depressed and it makes it harder to learn and you can't change your brain. So you feel more stressed and depressed. You can see how this becomes just a really negative cycle. So one of the things exercise does is it increases the expression of those growth factors. It pumps them up. And we think that's one reason why it helps learning. It also lowers cortisol. So it's a way of kind of pulling these things back into balance. And so it's another kind of opportunity to do something and try to kind of push your brain back into a healthier state.
Yeah, definitely. And I like speaking from experience, I would say 2018, maybe a little earlier, I had a real bad issue with mental health, really severely depressed. And I had to have a lot of therapy and medication and bits and bobs after. But today, yeah, I don't take any antidepressants, and my kind of go-to is exercise. Like I'm out all the time. I'm training for a marathon at the moment, and it's for me, it's those abilities to go through that kind of that pain, and I do feel that like my brain and my outlook has dramatically evolved through that period of trauma. Right. So one of the reasons I wanted to speak to you was because of your field of expertise and the understanding that. Yeah, how I resonated with the TED talk that I watched a while ago, and the ability for us to mold our brains to change the way that we live our lives. And for me, speaking from experience, it's definitely helped me. It's no guarantee for others. This is why I'm intrigued about the personalized medication and personalized learning to explore. But yeah, like I can only see positive benefits when, you know, like trauma is one thing, but it's not a defining factor in my view.
Yes, I agree 100%. I'm really so pleased to hear that you were able to find kind of a path through that. It's such a difficult process to come through, right? And then to find a solution that's working, you know, for you now. And you know, it's really a positive thing to think about. And I hope the knowledge is empowering that if you're in a dark place or you're hurting or you have some kind of injury or disease, you can change your brain to help make it better. You may not cure the whole thing, but you can definitely facilitate improvement that's going to make your life different and hopefully your life better. So yeah, I have always come to exercise. I tend to be very anxious. So I'm one of those people that I also run. And if I don't, I honestly just can't sleep. I just am awake and then things kind of can go badly quickly from there. So it's just something that I found I need. I know there are people though that don't care for exercise, and there are other ways to kind of get at this because it's certainly not for everyone. We did a study a few years back, a study of yoga, and a graduate student of mine came to me and she's like, I want to study yoga and I want to look at the ability of people who practice yoga to kind of mitigate stress and anxiety. We decided to compare yoga, people who, we call them yogis, people who do yoga just three times a week. They're not crazy yoga masters, but they just go regularly to your yoga class. So I decided to compare them to recreational runners because I was kind of being a jerk. And I was like, well, there's going to be no difference. The runner's going to be just as good at that. A little bit of arrogance since I'm a runner. And what we did was we designed an experiment where we would put these two groups, we put them in the MRI scanner, and we showed them some videos that are known to elicit different emotions. There was a happy video, and there was a really upsetting video. It was from Schindler's List, and a very angry video clip. It was just clips. The other one's from a movie called I Am Sam. And they're kind of, they've been psychologically validated to elicit these different emotions. And we studied two things. We studied heart rate variability, which is a surrogate of stress and stress management. And we did brain imaging, and we were looking in particular at the amygdala, which is a brain region known for a strong emotional response. So it turned out that the only thing where the runners, you know, showed an advantage was in physical fitness. They had a better VO2 max, better aerobic capacity, which they should because they run, they're trained for it. But the people who did yoga regularly showed a much more adaptive heart rate response when we stressed them out. So instead of getting really stressed, that's what the runners did. The yoga people, they were more like observers. They saw this horrible video, but they didn't really react. And at the same time, we saw in their brain that same kind of pattern of they observed it, they saw it, they acknowledged. We could see the amygdala kind of turned on, but it didn't go crazy. It didn't light way up. And so we do, for whatever reason, think that there's maybe something about a practice of yoga, and maybe it's the stretching, maybe it's the mindfulness, maybe it's just taking time 3 times a week to do something for yourself. We're not really sure what it is, but it does seem to confer this benefit on stress management. So that's another way that you can think about managing stress, anxiety, mood is just by, you know, taking this time for yourself and thinking about it. And there's other work that's not mine that looks at mindfulness, not necessarily meditation, but just more taking a, you know, few times a day to be mindful about how you feel and what your environment is and kind of touching base with yourself. And that may also be a very healthy way of managing depression and stress. So I kind of tie these back. I think that one of the things I haven't had a chance to touch on yet, but we know that our brains are actually never at rest. Our brains are always active. If I put you in the MRI scanner and I said, just lay there and do nothing, try not to fall asleep, your brain doesn't just turn off. It's still highly active. And it actually, when we kind of are seemingly doing nothing, our brain goes to this, it's called the default mode network. There's a very stereotypic pattern of brain activity that comes out when we're resting or doing nothing. And it turns out that a lot of us think, and I would include myself in them, that our brains actually need these periods through the day where we're seemingly doing nothing. So it's a bit of a break, a little bit of a reset for the brain. It may be good for stress management. Some of my colleagues have done work suggesting that this may be when we have spontaneous creativity, where you just like, oh, I get it. I solved the math problem. I know what to do there. If you're an artist, things come to you in these kind of moments of doing nothing. And they seem to be really healthy. And it may be that that is enabled by something like practicing yoga or taking a long run or taking a long walk. You're just giving your brain the opportunity to wander and to not be on a task.
Yeah, definitely. Because, well, we're switched on all the time, aren't we? So when we have the ability to step out of that environment, I would definitely relate it to running. If you're doing a decent enough distance and, you know, there's just you and the road ahead of you, then over a longer duration, you do just switch off and you're just more in the moment and in the present. I think that's kind of, it helps me from a mindfulness perspective, just to kind of stay anchored and stay a little bit focused upon the task at hand rather than all of the other narratives that are portraying and playing out in our daily lives.
Right. And there may be something that's very essentially healthy about that. You know, there's a lot of work going on around that. So we're going to run next year a study in collaboration with some of my colleagues in education, looking at burnout in teachers. So it turns out that at least here in Canada and British Columbia, where I am, teachers and nurses are the most burned out of our professionals. And so that's a real problem, right? You hate to have someone who's as important. You have 3 children. I have 2. I don't want their teachers to be just totally burned out. That's awful. And so it's a study where we're looking at using a meditation, teaching a meditation to these teachers and looking to see if we can both positively affect their burnout and also their brain health by helping them to have a tool where they can perhaps get to one of these more mindful kind of spaces in their days. So there's a lot of acute interest around that area of kind of trying to build these things into our daily lives very consciously.
Yeah, definitely. And I'd be intrigued to see how that plays out, because like if you look at issues within the UK, for example, doctors and nurses, my wife being a doctor, like so many amazing people that have gone through, you know, 7, 8, 9 years of training to become what they've always wanted to be. And then they're in environments where they're severely understaffed, that they're leaving professions because of burnout and depression. And I think it's sad. We kind of need to be supporting and empathizing with those that are taking care of us, because they also need to be taken care of themselves. So
absolutely. Yeah,
I'm intrigued as to how that work plays out. But back to what we talked about previously about personalized medicines and personalized learning. Yeah, like how do you envisage this transforming in the fields of, you mentioned education, and we also touched upon healthcare, but also beyond, I guess?
Yeah. Well, I think the big learning here is that each of us, our brains are as unique as each of us are, right? There's certain stereotypic features in the brain, but if I scan your brain and my brain, they're totally different. And that's a result of our genetics, our environment, all the experiences we've had. You know, musicians have brains that look really different than people who are non-musicians, et cetera. And so I think that knowledge allows us to then kind of celebrate those differences, try to unpack them, and then start to design experiences that are more specific to that individual capacity or brain. I don't think we actually need a brain scan to do that for everyone, but I do think that it would be exciting if we could start to design almost like decision trees, if you will, algorithms. I don't want to make this a computerized thing. I don't want AI doing this for me particularly, but trying to understand for this type of person, for this type of learning experience, what would really be the best practice scenario, way to teach, a way to develop so that they can optimize the brain that they actually have. And I think that in healthcare in particular, that's going to be really, really important. In fact, it's essential for us to start to make progress towards helping people who've had stroke, for example, recover from that particular injury. And so that's kind of the idea there. And so that's what we're working where it takes a lot of data. That's the kind of big problem here, is we need big data in order to start to sort out all of these different subpopulations. But we're certainly heading in that direction.
Yeah, definitely. And it's intriguing to see where we're going to evolve into. Like you did mention AI then, but in respect to how healthcare is going to evolve in the next like 5-10 years, it's just going to be astounding. And it's
going to be so different, I think. Yeah. My concern with AI is that the decisions AI will make are only as good as the data we put into it. So I just don't feel like we have enough data, enough diversity in data right now to even start to, that's my real concern. So if you look at, you know, medical data, for example, it's largely dominated by Western European, white, and actually about 60 to 70% men versus, you know, males versus females. So we don't even have an equal representation of biological sex, let alone different racial and ethnic minorities, ages. There's a lot that would have to be done there before you can actually start to generate really good AI-based kind of decision-making in healthcare. But it is coming rapidly. So I think we all have to kind of get ready.
It'll be intriguing as well, that trade-off, because at the moment, you know, one of the biggest sources of data that you probably get from a healthcare perspective is the UK's NHS. But in that respect, there's also there's a company, I think they're called Palantir, that are behind the data now. They're a US-based company and that have managed to get that contract. But then still there's a massive pushback from people that just do not want their personal data utilized in that way. So I'm intrigued to see how that plays out. And also, there's a long way to go until we get the ability to utilize that big data. And I guess it's more so the societal implications upon what people feel could be used in detriment to themselves and also used to advance society. That's an intriguing thing to play out. But talking about society, like what are the broader implications of your findings on neuroplasticity, especially in terms of lifelong learning and behavioral change? Because we've talked about experiences and a few examples, but we haven't really talked about the behavioral change element.
Your brain is going to change to reflect whatever it is you're doing. So I say choose your behaviors carefully. That's the essence of neuroplasticity is, and that happens throughout the lifespan. So if you retire and your big daily activity is watching TV and pushing the remote control, your brain will reorganize and you'll have a really big thumb representation for pushing the remote control, right? So that's the peril, if you will, of neuroplasticity is it can go the other way as well. And this is where you see if you have depression or chronic pain, addiction, your brain has reorganized to kind of be focused on and to center its kind of activity, both morphologically, both its size and shape, and its chemical structure and its excitability patterns. Those will all reflect what those things you've been practicing. Mm-hmm. So we here in Canada have a terrible addiction crisis, opioid crisis. It's just shocking and terrible. And I think often about these people who, in order to kind of stop that, to break that cycle of addiction, not only do you have to kind of replace the addiction and have them withdraw, but that withdrawal is associated with totally reorganizing the brain, right? It's really, really hard. It's painful. It takes time. It takes practice. It takes patience and compassion. And so the same with a pain patient. I teach in the medical school. I teach in the physiotherapy program at the university. And I have people who are interested in orthopedics. And if you want to make that hurt shoulder better or that hurt knee better, you can't just focus here. You're also going to have to change the brain, which is interpreting those pain signals. They're going hand in glove. So that's the one side of it that is kind of the downside. The upside is we can change, right? Let's say I decided I would really love to play the piano and I'm not super young, but and it's not going to be easy or pretty, but I can start plunking away and make a reasonable start at it. Now, I'll have to change my brain, but I can change it that direction too, right? So it kind of can go either direction.
Yeah, it comes down to the forming of habits, isn't it? And the ability to compound those daily actions because, you know, you mentioned addiction and what, like addiction at the crux is a habit and it's the, you know, like the people may be utilizing it, be it opioids or be it gambling as a form of escapism from a wider challenge. But until you're able to pivot back and see what the actual root cause is, then you're not really able to really address the habits that are formed from the basis of its negative actions. So it's intriguing, but yeah, like it is a long route because yeah, this the UK, I think we've got quite a problem with gambling in this country. So there's a lot of stuff that's taking place, but then equally, I don't think anybody's really looking at the root cause of the source. And I think, you know, back to society, there's a lot of issues that are playing out in the UK in respect to, I don't know, a lot of people feel that they're left behind in respect to how our society in the UK is evolving. So it's intriguing. As I say, when I jumped on this call, I was really intrigued just to pick your brain. Yeah, it's been fantastic. But before we close out, I just want to kind of ask you two lasting questions. Firstly, one being, what advice would you give to our listeners in respect to how they could consciously shape their brains and foster more of a positive neuroplasticity within their daily lives? And secondly, what would your closing thought and key takeaway be for those listening?
Sure. Well, so the shaping neuroplasticity and kind of brain health, we've talked a lot about exercise, so you've already heard about that. The other piece I didn't talk about that is going to be really key is when we start to make a new memory, we have to take that memory from a short term, we have to put it into a long term so we can access it later, right? So you can remember what we talked about on this call in a week or 2 weeks. And essential to that is sleep. So that's the other kind of key element here. So managing your stress, getting your exercise, and then lastly, for long-term brain health, you really need to have a good sleep habit because we know that those different phases of sleep that we're encountering every night are quite essential for taking a short-term memory and helping it be converted into a long-term memory. And that actually causes a physical change in the structure in our brain. And so that's why it takes time. Why it exactly takes sleep? I'm not sure. And I'm not sure anyone actually knows, but it might be a cool topic for another podcast. But what's special about sleep is a really, really interesting question in neuroscience. We all do it. It's a big waste of time. So it must be important. Why are we doing that? So that's the other kind of key element there of kind of taking and trying to really shape your brain. And then effort and motivation. Find something hard and try to learn it. So there's also seems to be something really key about effort. So if it's not hard, you're not changing your brain. So if it's simple to do something, you already had enough brain to do it, that's fine. But if you really want to shape your brain, you really want to challenge your brain and have it shift and reorganize and become neuroplastic, it's got to be challenging. So So you have to be able to, it can't be so hard that you can't do it. It's got to be in that sweet spot of hard but doable. So there's nothing wrong with failure. That just means you're working on the edge of difficulty. And so, you know, I'm always encouraging people to try stuff that's really, really hard as they're learning and wanting to shape their brain. And my real big takeaway is we only have one brain. You can shape it however way you choose to. So choose well, do things that make you feel good and bring you joy and are healthy for your brain. And you'll have it for working for you for a long time. Hopefully then you can maintain that for the whole span of your life, because you're not going to lose that learning capacity as you age, as long as you're continuing to be effortful and taking care of it as best you can. So I hope that's a very optimistic message. I think it is. It is for me.
Yeah, definitely. It's an amazing, amazing finish. But thank you so, so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.